Kaya, welcome. Hello. Welcome to another episode of the Curb Podcast. My name is Andrew F. Pierce. I am coming to you from Boorloo, Western Australia, and I'm joined by Nadine Whitney, who is coming to you from Nam, Victoria. And we are here to do another quick rundown discussion episode of a few films. Nadine, what are we going to be talking about today?
We are going to be talking about Nosferatu. So Robert Eggers' interpretation of Nosferatu, partly Murnau, partly Herzog, partly going back to Stoker, and partly his own thing. So it stars Lily Rose Depp as Ellen Hutter, Nicholas Hoult as Thomas Hutter, Bill Skarsgård as Count Orlok. We have Aaron Taylor-Johnson as the highly annoying Friedrich Harding, Willem Dafoe as Professor Alban Eberhard von Franz, or ostensibly who we would call Van Helsing, Emma Corrin as Friedrich's wife, Anna Harding, Ralph Ineson as William Sievers, Simon McBurney as Nock, and a bunch of other people who we don't know because they are
blood bags. Blood bags.
Sorry? Blood they bags. Blood bags. Okay, so Andrew, just a quick impression. What did you feel about
that? Oh, I love this film. I absolutely loved it. I mean, I'm all in on Robert Eggers, like a lot of people are, and I think that The Lighthouse is probably the best thing he's done, but this is a very close second. The visuals of this film and the kind of the hardness of the horror, I was really, really impressed by how horrific it actually is. And I think that one of the things which is often forgotten about in discussions about horror films is that they can often be fun. They can often be, you know, this great dalliance in darkness and all this kind of stuff. But with Eggers' Nosferatu, he really, to me at least, leans into what makes horror horror and why something is horrific. And it's because it's bleak. There's no hope. There is darkness. There is nothing but absolute darkness and despair, and people aren't going to end happily. And it's just, look, I had a great time. It's funny that we live in a world where we are faced with unceasing darkness every single day. You open up your news apps and all this kind of stuff and you see the darkness and you go, I can't deal with this. But then you sit down and watch a film like Nosferatu and you go, I can deal with this because it is so out there. You know, there are certainly, we won't go into all the myths and the legends of vampires and all this kind of stuff, but to me, Nosferatu is something that's so easily accessible, partially because it feels so distant from our reality, but yet it is still dark and fearful. And a lot of that has to do with, I think, Lily Rose Depp, who I just think is just phenomenal here. There's a particular scene midway through the film where she has what can only really be described as a freak out that just, I think, is one of the best scenes I've seen all year. I think that she is just absolutely phenomenal in this one moment where she has effectively a panic attack on screen and starts, you know, trying to tear her clothes off in fear and anxiety and stress, and this creeping hold that this being has, played wonderfully by Bill Skarsgård, who just, I mean, I don't know what's going on in that guy's mind, but he does a really good job of portraying very cruel and mean and horrific people. But those two, I think, really bring the film to life. Nicholas Hoult is also very good. I surprisingly didn't mind Aaron Taylor-Johnson here, even though he still hasn't really got the whole line delivery thing down pat. But to me, I think it just worked wonderfully. What about you?
I enjoy gothic horror, and I love all vampire myths. I mean, I don't know how many vampire books I've read, and you know, it's my thing. And I have seen so many vampire films that I've lost the ability to count. But I'm really glad that we're getting back to, well, at least Eggers is getting back to the very base idea that a vampire is a horrible, disgusting being, and that there is no redeeming quality for Count Orlok in this film, none whatsoever. He is just relentlessly awful. And as you said, this creeping dread, this predetermined collapse of sanity, of reason, up against this not even mythical evil. I mean, it's a satanic evil. And I very much enjoyed that. And I enjoyed how Eggers uses color. There are essentially two color palettes in the film. There's blue and there's orange. And that's it. You know, they're your colors that you get. And that's quite gorgeous. Occasionally you get a bit of purple, because I think that color is Ellen's color.
Mm. And it's a color that's often associated with, people who have been drained of life in a way as well, because
it's in the Victorian era. It was the color that you wore after you came out of black for mourning. So a lilac dress was what you wore. So it is associated with death as well. I think Lily Rose Depp is doing an incredible job. For me, Simon McBurney was having the time of his life. Some of the poses he got to do as Knocker are just incredible.
Well, yeah, there's a scene, sorry to interrupt, but there's a scene where he's sitting in a chair, and I won't say what he's doing in the chair, but he's sitting in the chair, and that moment is just a full-bodied experience, and you can tell that he is absolutely loving the extremes of what he's able to do in that moment. He is having an absolute delight. It's great.
and I also enjoyed the commentary that was delivered to about, you know, the birth of rational sciences and how they still and will always view women as secondary and hysterical. So one of the first things that Ralph Ineson's doctor does is say, well, we've got to tie her up. You know, she's a somnambulist, so we definitely need to tie her up, and then we're going to bleed her. And you know, Ellen's going, look, I'm not insane. This is happening. And she essentially lives in the household of Aaron Taylor Johnson's character, who is a shipping magnet. He's saying, you know, I don't like her. I don't like the way that she acts. You know your place, woman. And her place is, you're all going to die.
Yes. See, but there's something that's delicious about that. Like, there is something that is really quite enjoyable about the manner of acknowledging all of that, of the way that women are controlled in the film. And I'm not saying that it's enjoyable to see that happen, but it's enjoyable to see somebody acknowledge that it exists and that, you know, it was a reality in that time. And yet, the acknowledgement and the understanding that it exists is also a critique of it, and to say, let's not go back there. Let's not do that again. Let's not go down to that path. And in a lot of ways, horror films can be warnings for things. They can be a portent for the future and stuff like that. They can be, say, look, we've done dark things. Let's not do those dark things again. And I'm not trying to say that Nosferatu is a commentary on the modern state and all this kind of stuff, but it is part of the text of the film. And I enjoyed seeing that play out on this particular film. Again, it's why I think that it's such a powerful film. One of the questions which I've had in the past week that somebody had raised to me about this film was that there has been conversations about the role of chronic illness for the narrative of Nosferatu over the different iterations. I'm curious if that's something that we both live with chronic illness, and I'm curious if that's something that you had seen in this particular film or understood as something taking place in the film.
No, I didn't.
Good, because I didn't see it either. So
I missed that, but usually I'm quite sensitive to those representations, and you know, I guess that, you know, Ellen's life force and Thomas's life force are being drained by this being, but that's not quite the same as chronic illness. And the idea that Ellen was going to end up in a psychiatric hospital, that's just the period too. So
it was a question that was raised on social media that somebody had asked me about whether that was something I'd noticed. And again, it's, I think we talked about in the last episode about the textual nature of films and the way that we can read what we want sometimes, whether it's in the film or not. And I think that for me, I didn't read it there. Doesn't mean that for others it's not there, but I think that from at least an initial viewing, you really need to kind of sink your teeth in a little bit more, pun not intended, about what you want to try and find in that regard. I don't think that Robert Eggers is trying to say anything about chronic illness or anything like that with the film. He is literally just presenting a very dark, shadowy figure who is horrific and does it extremely, extremely well. I've been fascinated by his exploration of darkness on screen. As we all know, The Witch and The Lighthouse in particular, The Northman less so, but, you know, those two initial films are really quite unique presentations of darkness, and that's why he's been able to stand out as a filmmaker. And I think that he does it well here. It shows that if he has a budget and the ability to kind of explore these kinds of things on a grander scale, that it becomes a more satisfying experience. So as we kind of wrap up the discussion of Nosferatu, what, I guess, would your final thoughts and your rating for the film be?
Mine would be 4 very sharp teeth out of 5, mostly because it is dealing with the concept of the vampire as an ancient and creeping evil. And there are fewer rats in this one than in Herzog. So that's a good start, because also we have plague narratives within it, which we didn't speak about. I also kind of giggled at the implied necrophilia. So there's something that worked for me too.
I completely agree. I think it's a wonderful film. My initial rating was very enthusiastic. I think I initially rated it at 5 stars, but I'll probably drop that down to a 4.5 now. I think that is, there may be some kind of shaggier elements as the film goes on that could have been reduced. There's a scene where Aaron Taylor-Johnson does an attempt at crying, which I don't think works so well and robs the film of the emotional moment it deserves. But other than that, I think that it's a really phenomenal film. I'm excited to see where Eggers goes from here, because it seems there's a lot of attention for this particular experience. So, yeah, 4.5 from me out of 5 with sharp pointy teeth, with 1 half having snapped off in a poor victim's neck.
Yes. Baby girl, yeah, Harris. The loveliest person on the planet, Harris Dickinson. Yeah. I've heard of Baby Rossi, yeah. And I'd strongly encourage it. And I think the order should go Nosferatu, then Baby Girl. You know, Baby Girl is the, like, uplifting, sexy palate cleanser.
Let's shift over to talking to something that is completely related in tone and style and everything else, which is Better Man, directed by Michael Gracey. Would you like to give a rundown of this film, or would you like me to give a rundown of this film and why it's associated with Nosferatu?
Okay, please associate. No, I think it's associated with Nosferatu in one aspect, and that's addiction.
Yes, pretty much it, yeah. Yeah. There are no digital apes in Nosferatu, but there is a digital ape in this one who is certainly addicted in different ways. This is, as people know, it is the story of Robbie Williams from his childhood to his success as a boy band member and then as a solo artist. What's your feelings on Robbie Williams to begin with?
Well, I can honestly say that I don't remember ever having heard a Take That song in my life. Until because I was a little bit too old for it, you know, they were what, 92 when they kind of broke out. It was 1992. I was 21. I was listening to other things, as you know, a lot of people were, because grunge had happened, and for me, I was listening to more sort of trip hop and Radiohead and that kind of stuff. So it didn't quite that didn't revolve around in my head, but Robbie Williams himself as a solo artist definitely got my attention. So I find that fascinating in itself, because I would say generally I'm not a huge, hey, pop is great fan, but Robbie Williams, he just charmed me. He charmed me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and same for me. Like, should add, I'm wearing a Spice Girls shirt at the moment. So I grew up in, you know, the era of the 90s where boy bands and girl bands were really a thing. Not that they weren't in the, you know, 60s, 70s and 80s, but they became this manufactured thing to a different level in the 90s. And I wasn't that much of a Take That fan, but again, just like you, I really loved Robbie Williams and grew to really appreciate his cheekiness and the drive that he had in pushing boundaries. I mean, I bought the CD single of Rock DJ simply because it had the video on it as well, and I used to watch that video over and over and over again. And if people haven't seen the uncut video for Rock DJ, I highly recommend you doing so, because it features Robbie Williams in the middle of this kind of roller disco-y ball thing, and he's singing to this group of women who are skating around him, and then he takes off his clothes, gets naked, and then he starts pulling his skin off, and then he rips his muscles off to the point where it's just a dancing skeleton in front of everybody. And, you know, Rock DJ is this hyper-pop song. It's this wicked song, which we'll talk about in a moment, because it is the pinnacle moment of the film too. But this kind of self-awareness that Robbie has as an artist is driven through music videos like Rock DJ, which I think is just phenomenal. And then there is that self-awareness of that with Better Man, where he had basically said, look, I'm more than happy to let you do an adaptation of my life, but it has to be that a digital ape plays me. And that's what we get. And it works so, so well. I mean, I've been tracking this film since it was first announced back in 2018, thereabouts, and have been wanting to see whether they actually have committed to the bit, and they do. And this brilliantly performed ape by John O'Davies, who got an actor nomination, which is, I think, the first time that, well, in at least in Australia, it is the first time that a motion capture performance has been given an award nomination. So wonderful to see. But it just goes there. And that's so exciting to see some, you know, a film take risks and boundary pushing and all this kind of stuff. And yeah, okay, the formula of a biopic story like this is kind of still very formulaic in a lot of ways. But the manner that they decide to kind of challenge it with a digital ape, with having a sequence like the Rock DJ sequence, is really quite wonderful. And I think, you know, 2024 has had a few of these kinds of films that have really pushed the boundaries of what usual music biopic would be about. I'm thinking of, like, the Pharrell Williams one, Piece by Piece, which is a Lego stop motion animated film. And it's just taking something that we're very familiar with and putting a new spin on it. And I think that's really quite enjoyable. I don't think Piece by Piece works all that well, but the idea of taking a very familiar story and making it new is nice. But I think that it works so well here. I absolutely love this film. I think it is ridiculously entertaining. And that is the core ethos of who Robbie Williams is as a person. He wants to entertain you. I mean, it's literally one of his iconic songs is "Let Me Entertain You." And I think that this is a pure representation of that mindset. Did you have that same experience? Because you've seen it twice. You watched it at home and then you went and watched it at cinema. So were you entertained three times? There we go. Yeah.
So I was less entertained at home because it is, for me, a big screen film. Like, to get the full effect of the music and you know, just this, these incredible sequences and the way that Michael Gracie puts Robbie's music in at different points and the transitions when they come in is extraordinary. There are scenes, for example, where is it Come Undone that he uses after Robbie has just quit Take That. He's driving, and he's driving so fast, and he's singing this song, and in his mind he crashes into a river, and the fangirls are like sharks pulling him down. It's terrifying. It's actually a terrifying moment, and you can feel that all of the things that Robbie is talking about in terms of his addictions to fame itself, his drug addiction, his sex addiction, you know, all of these things made him so vulnerable and so self-loathing that he didn't quite know what to do with himself at any stage. And with the whole digital ape thing, I forgot after a while I was watching an ape. I was just watching Robbie Williams.
Yeah, which I think is the desired effect. And, you know, he is different, but he's not. And as you're saying, like, you forget that it is a digital ape. You're not thinking, oh, this is the next Planet of the Apes film. You're thinking that's Robbie Williams on screen. And it's because it's so seamlessly just kind of fits in with everything and the mood and the tone of the film, which let's talk about the rock DJ sequence, which I think is just a jaw-dropping sequence and probably one of the best musical sequences I've seen in recent years. It is a phenomenal one take, and it's digitally stitched together, of course, but this one take sequence, which flows in from a building out into the streets, and the choreography and the explosion of excitement and energy and the vibrance that is going on in this particular sequence is just like, you know, it's the kind of thing, like, I think of when I was a kid and you go and see musicals and people would jump out of their seats, like going to see Moulin Rouge and people jumping out of their seats when the Can-Can song comes in and they're dancing along. And like now I'd probably be a little bit like, hey, don't do that. That's a silly move. But I feel like a sequence like Rock DJ is that kind of jump out of your seat and dance along sequence. Did you get that kind of experience? What was your views on the Rock DJ sequence?
Well, I thought it was amazing. And that's one of the few pieces that's actually filmed in London. So that was filmed on the street, you know. So to do that in the first place is extraordinary. Michael Gracie is a genius for getting that done. I adored, you know, the way that they go through, you know, the different feelings, like they're the Beatles at one point, they're, you know, they're whoever, you know, Take That become this boy band of all boy bands. And that was extraordinary. And they're jumping in places, in stores, outside of stores, stopping, picking up coats, putting on sunglasses. And the dancing is amazing. And the dancing is, you know, a lot of the people who are in the film as members of Take That, I think two of them are actually just dancers, Australian dancers who have then taken on parts as members of Take That. And then a couple of them are actors, British actors who are in it it's amazing. And seeing digital Ape Robbie with the angel wings of Regent Street in the background, you know, because angel wings is something that Robbie uses a lot, angels and devils generally as motifs in his, and Take That did too, in their visual language. Fantastic.
Oh, it really is. I just think this is like Michael Gracie. I did not like The Greatest Showman. I thought that it was a mess of a film, but there was an energy to it that was quite exciting. And you know, he certainly has done a really interesting job of building something that is very unique and interesting here. I see that he's going to do a live action Tangled adaptation next, which kind of disappoints me because I had hoped that he would continue on with this boundary pushing form of musicals in a way. But at the very least, at least we got Better Man, and I know that in America, not very many people know of Robbie Williams, so I'm not sure it'll be a huge success there. But in the UK and Australia, it seems to be doing quite well, which is good. Not that we should really care about the financial box office take of a film, but it does encourage more filmmakers to make films like it. Again, I absolutely love this. I think this is one of the most inventive and enjoyable films to come out of 2024, and I'm glad that it exists. And I'm glad that it came out at the time that it did, because it's kind of a kick-in-the-ass film. I give this a 4.5 stars. What would you give it?
I would give it 4 stars, and specifically I just wanted to quickly talk about another biopic, which is similar in a way, which is the Elton John one, Rocket Man, which uses Elton's songs in as musical numbers. And I came out of that film disliking Elton John more than I had previously disliked Elton John. I think that is a bad idea. If you go into a film and you come out going, you know, I now like this man even less. But he walks into a therapy scene, therapy group, and sits down. Robbie Williams in his therapy group says the most extraordinary thing, which is the key to the film, where he just says, "No, I'm just a chav who got everything he ever wanted." And he's kind of embarrassed to be there, but he also says, "I'm stunted, you know." They say that people stay the age they are when they became famous, and I was 15. I'm unevolved. I didn't grow up. And that's when there's this breakthrough of getting properly sober and making up for what he's done in the past to the people he put. And ends in 2005 with a very lovely concert where he's much more generous with somebody who caused him harm than a lot of people would be.
Yeah, it is that kind of film. Like, there is, you're not walking out of it feeling like he's a terrible person, even though you've seen him do terrible things. You feel like he is a human.
He admits it, and, you know, he just says, you know, people want to slap me in the face, and, you know, kind of fair enough, you know.
Why don't you go first?
This is what always happens in the kitchen. I think doing the big birth scene, yeah, which is like the emotional centerpiece of the film, that was really exciting.
I loved having my baby bump. That was really lovely. This is really
satisfying. Yeah. I like cooking a spag bol. I like cooking a lamb roast. That's my favourite thing to cook.
I like cooking one-pot dishes, stews. I like doing bolognese's. Mm. I like doing soups.
I get more stressed cooking for other people than I think Florence does, because I'm not as gifted as her at it.
I think we have a similar amount of drive. I think we're both similar in being quite stubborn. Why are you similar to Tobias?
Codependent. I get all sticky with other people's feelings.
So the next film that we'll talk about is John Crowley's We Live in Time, which is a beautiful, beautiful drama that features Andrew Garfield as Tobias and Florence Pugh as Almut, and they are, well, they meet each other when she runs into him and causes him to have an accident, and from there their love life kind of flows into marriage and beyond. The way that this film is structured is an out-of-order structure, effectively playing with time itself and the role of memories and the way that our present engages with our past, engages with our future, engages with who we want to be, who we think we will be, and what our drive and desire is. And it's most pointedly felt in the notion that Florence Pugh's character Almut is a chef, and she desperately wants to live that chef life, but then gets pulled away from it for different reasons. And one of those reasons is that they find out that she has cancer. And this is that kind of weepy, I guess is the best way of putting it, where these two actors are just gifted these two roles that are distinctly human, and they're distinctly kind people as well. In the way that John Crowley does, he is such an empathetic director. If people saw Brooklyn, they have an idea of how he engages with empathy, with storytelling, and most importantly, with time. And I did an interview recently with John Crowley where I did ask him about the role of time in his work and how he plays with time, because he so keenly is aware of how time impacts us as people. And most importantly, how time impacts us when we're away from people that we love spending time with, our family, our loved ones, or in the case of Almut, the work that she enjoys doing, which is cooking. She is a magnificent chef. And of course, Florence Pugh, we all know from her, yes, her film work, but also from her Cooking with Florence social media presence as well. It's not a conscious thing that was chosen to be implemented in the film, but it's wonderfully driven here. And then there is Andrew Garfield, who I think what I absolutely love about Andrew Garfield in this particular role here is how he generously supports Almut in a way that he is so deeply in awe of her as a person that he would do anything to help her have the life that she wants, even when she breaks his heart. And gosh, I just love this film to bits. I think that it is so beautifully presented. It is so tenderly performed. I think that Andrew Garfield and Florence Pugh are given rather thankless roles here in a way, on the surface, because they are just run-of-the-mill people. But that is almost one of the hardest things to be able to do, is to perform as a run-of-the-mill person, as somebody who has wants and desires, because they are such generic things. They're so human, yet they're so base level that exploring that and bringing it to life on screen is really hard. And yet the two of them together are just, gosh, it's a film that breaks my heart. But it also makes me feel so much better for having spent time with it, because you see yourself in this, in their stories, in so many different ways. Was that something that you felt when you watched this film?
What I strongly resonated with was just this strong notion of goodness throughout it. You know, Tobias's dad, played by it's Douglas Hodge, I think, he's just a great guy. He's completely behind his son, 100%. And, you know, Almut and Tobias don't always get along. You know, he gets quite bossy and she gets quite, you know, nasty back, because they're trying to work out what they want. And, you know, Almut originally, you know, doesn't necessarily want to have a child. And he's saying, well, you know, I've gotten divorced and, you know, time's running out for me and I want a child and we have to work this out now. And she said, but can't we wait? And so you've got all these things in the mix, but, you know, the trailer at least will tell you as much, that one, she has cancer. Two, they do have a child. They have a child called Elle, and she's approximately 4 or 5. and they're going to have to tell her what's happening. I guess at this point in time, with Garfield as a performer, he is just so accomplished that if he is upset with something, I tend to be upset with it as well.
Yeah.
I used to have that reaction with Martin Donovan. If you upset Martin Donovan in a film, I too was upset. I would cry. Not so much in The Apprentice, but, you know, before then, that there are certain actors that you feel so connected to because of their performances. What you said about them being ordinary people is, yes, they are ordinary people. I mean, he works for a snack company, and
which is as generic as they come. Like it's there's nothing glamorous about it, and that
it's Weetabix, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, he works for Weetabix.
Yeah, and that's what I love as well, is because it is so generic, right? It's so basic, and yet that's a nourishing thing that we often reach to in the morning for a lot of people who go for the Weetabix or, you know, the basic cereal, because it's there, it's what we do. And I think there is an art to creating a film like this, which John Crowley has managed to master over the years, where it is rather, on the surface, technically basic, right? But it's the manner that it works. And it, like, this sounds like really, really faint praise, but it's like it does its job. And it does its job extremely well. Like I find myself just getting so emotional about the manner that these two characters interact with one another. And yes, as you're saying, like Andrew Garfield is such an emotionally charged actor as well. If he gets hurt, I get hurt. And the same with Florence Pugh as well. Like I've known her as, for many people, like probably getting to know her through Lady Macbeth, such a harsh, harsh character in that film. So getting to see her play a softer side, even her character in Little Women, which is also a slightly harsher, one of the harsher sisters, yet there is a softness to her there. And we're getting to experience her even softer here. She's just wonderful. I love seeing her on screen. The two have chemistry for miles. Like, I hope this is not the only time that we get to see them interact with one another on screen, because they're delightful. And they genuinely care about spending time with one another. And they genuinely care about making good entertainment. And, you know, I think of the films where we want something to comfort us, and there is a reason why we want something to comfort us. And We Live in Time is exactly that kind of film. It is a comfort film. It just, you've got to let yourself go to that point, to let yourself be taken there. And it's interesting, I recently watched for the first time The Holiday, which is not really a film that is on the same level as We Live in Time, but my cousin was watching it for Christmas, and she said that's her comfort film. It's a film that moves her in a way that is unexpected, and there is an authenticity in that film which is slightly artificial. I feel the authenticity in We Live in Time is more authentic than The Holiday, but what I'm trying to say, I guess, is that when we sit down and watch a comfort movie, we do so because that level of authenticity matches what we need in that moment. And for me, We Live in Time is that kind of film. I can't wait to revisit this over the years and grow with it and see how my memories of it and how time impacts my emotional reaction to it as well. I know that this is not for everybody. Like, I've seen some really, really harsh or reactionary responses to the film where people have really pushed back against what it's doing on an emotional level, and maybe a little bit more manipulative than some of the dramas out there are. But for me, it just works completely. I think this is just a wonderful, wonderful film. I find it interesting that we're getting this in the beginning of the year. I think it comes out on the 16th of January in Australia. So it's an interesting kind of entry point to dramas for movie-going audiences in Australia. I hope that they respond to it in the way that I've responded to it.
Well, I think, you know, I hate to use the portmanteau term, but it's a dramedy.
Yes,
you know,
yeah.
The chemistry between Tobias and Amor is lovely. You know, they match each other on so many levels, and he is slight, you know, she is more outgoing than he is. You know, she's got more of a past. She's had, you know, a female partner in the past, and that's kind of like, oh, wow, for him, because he just hadn't even considered it. But by the time that you get to know them as a couple, which you get at the very beginning, like you start with them already as a pre-existing couple that have been together for quite a few years, the language and the way that they interact with each other in this very black comedy kind of way just worked for me in a visceral manner, because you do have that kind of shorthand with people that you've known for a long time and you trust, and you know, and they make a joke about, you know, buying a dog for their daughter so it can get used to that, so she can get used to the idea of death. And it's like, maybe we'd have to buy a really old dog, or will we kill a dog, you know? This is gallows humor, but also when you're going through these kinds of things, and you know, I've been through the things, being with somebody who had cancer and who was dying, you do start becoming very gallows humor about life, you know, the absurdity of it all. So, oh, and it has one of the best birth scenes you'll see.
Oh, it does, doesn't it? Yeah. Yeah. It reminded me of, it is not as intense as this film, but it reminded me of the 90s film Jude with Kate Winslet in it, which has also got a really impressive birthing scene that kind of just really just surprises with the visceral nature of it. So often we're not given that kind of...
But Jude the Obscure is incredibly depressing.
Oh, yeah. But the birth scene in particular.
Yeah, which also wasn't at, you know, in a restroom at a service station.
No. It is strange where your mind connects things, though. I guess that's one way of putting it. Yes.
Yes, it is a strange connection. But yes, my goodness, Jude the Obscure. Like, there's just nothing happy happens in that film at all.
So, what's your rating for We Live in Time then?
For me, it's a 3.5. I would have given it 4, but I can see slightly where people are pushing back against the slightly manipulative nature of the film. But I just like the two of them together too much to write it off. And you know, Nick Payne, the person who wrote it, I wasn't particularly fond of his previous film, Last Letter to My Lover, I think it was called.
The Last Letter from Your Lover.
From Your Lover, yeah.
Directed by Augustine Frizzell, and has everybody's favourite face, Felicity Jones, in it. Okay. I haven't seen that, but nonetheless. I thought he did a good job here, but I really like this. I give it 4.5 stars. I think it is that close to being a 5-star film for me. I just I'm in awe of the empathy and the character presentation. Look, I could go on and on and on about this, but I think for me, maybe the one thing that lingers is that this is a film that reminds you that you feel like you've got more time than you actually have. And so often you'll put off doing things that you go, well, I'll do that next year, I'll do that in the future. And then suddenly the future is here and you're on your deathbed and you've never done those things and you're filled with regret. And it sounds like such a trite thing to say, but the film does reinforce the notion that no, if you want to do those things, do it now. Make the time to make it happen now. And as the title suggests, we live in time, and then suddenly we have none of it. And that, I think, is such a powerful thing. And what I love so much about it is that it it treats that notion with respect, and it treats that concept, which is so often treated as like a twee thing, like very saccharine thing, with the level of
the one day.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love it. Again, 4.5 stars. I think it's absolutely beautiful, brilliant film. And it's wonderful to see John Crowley working again with Andrew Garfield. For those who haven't seen Boy A, go and watch that.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. But be prepared to be destroyed by Boy A. It's not an easy film at all, but that's Garfield's sort of breakthrough role. He is so very good in that.
Oh yes. Yeah. So as we kind of lead into the last discussion, we'll have a bit of a bonus chat about one of the biggest films of the year. I think it received something like 15 actor nominations thereabouts, because why not?
Because we know why.
How to Make Gravy, the adaptation of the Paul Kelly song.
Would you even call it that? I mean,
no, because I don't know that they actually even listened to the song to begin with. I find this, I watched this quite a while ago, and then I tried to rewatch it recently because it was the 21st of December. Note, like my original review of the film was basically, the song is about a letter being written on the 21st of December. The film was released on the 1st of December. That gives you an idea of how actually in tune with the song they actually are. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, I tried to watch it on Gravy Day again, just because there were people who were having emotional reactions to it and finding it was quite good. I gave it half an hour, and I've seen the whole thing, but I gave it half an hour again, and I just was not on the wavelength of this film. I think that this film fundamentally misunderstands what the song How to Make Gravy is about.
He's telling everyone you'll be home for his birthday. Will you?
I'll be out of here by July.
With good behavior.
But they talk about the reason why the song matters is that it doesn't matter what the person who's writing the letter has done. It's that there could be goodness in everybody, and that they can have some kind of redemption regardless of what the crime is. But this film is so keenly interested in what the crime is. It's so keenly interested in building up this family that feels disconnected from the working class roots of the song. There is a reason why, you know, a dollop of tomato sauce for that sweetness and extra tang is like, you know that they're using Gravox or something akin to whatever it is for the gravy, but they put in what they have on hand, tomato sauce, to make it a little bit more flavorful, because that's all they have, right? And yet the characters in this film have money. They have success. they have connections to a better life. And that goes against everything that Paul Kelly's music in that era was about. It was about working class people trying to get by.
Well, I'm not sure Joe and Rita have a huge amount of money.
No, but other characters do, like Brendan Thwaite's character, who's a musician, and there's a line early on in the film where,
and he's the person that the letter goes to.
But he's somebody who's like, oh, he's out always touring and stuff like this, and he's built up to be this grand thing. But he's not, and gosh, I'm talking a lot, but I really reacted negatively against this film. I felt like it was just a complete misunderstanding of what the song is, and a completely manufactured piece of pap.
Well, it's fascinating too, because it's co-written by Megan Washington, who is a musician and also happens to be married to the director and happens to have a role as the neighbor who quite fancies Brenton Thwaite's character. But that whole subplot goes nowhere, so why even mention it? So it's written by somebody who writes lyrics. and uses music, well, use music to express herself. So I find it absolutely baffling that she could misunderstand so immensely what it's about. And, you know, Hensel's character has three children, but we only care about one of them. Yeah, we only care about Angus. The other, the girls, Frank and Dolly, whatever. You know, Brenton, I'm not even going to remember the characters' names because they're just, yeah. You know, he has a daughter called Mary who, you know, he must have had when he was 12. You know, I don't even know because he's young and so he's got this, you know, almost adult daughter. You've got Damon Harriman, so we've got Aunt Kate Mulvaney, better man, now winds back in here, playing a married couple, and he's annoying because he works in banking, finance, real estate, I don't know, one of those jobs, and she's got a fairly moneyed job, and they live somewhere else, and then there are the uncles who live in Queensland, and we are not supposed to notice that the whole film is also shot in Queensland. So it takes them days, apparently, to drive down from an hour away. Anyway, so Henshaw's character is very upset because the siblings were absent while he took care of his dying mother. And they come back at around Christmas and he drinks and he's drinking more heavily and more heavily. And eventually he just snaps and assaults Damon Harriman's character, gets carted off to jail. And you find out he has a bit of an anger issue thing brewing. And his idea of what it is to be a man is somewhat a bit skewed, which is why he only cares about his son, Angus. And he meets Noel.
Well, I mean, that's it. Like, this is the level of the film completely misunderstands the song. It thinks that it's a Christmas song, right? And yeah, okay, on some level it is a Christmas song. But it's not a Christmas song that is like, you know, Good King Wenceslas. Like, it's not that. It's about family, right? And an Australian Christmas is not about Christmassy things, really. It's about connecting with family, and that's what this letter is this last ditch attempt to connect with the family because he's absent, you know. And I find it really insulting that Hugo Weaving is called Noel here and or Noel, and I find it really
yeah,
just
was my joke, yeah.
Yeah, but that's the level that the film, like, it's not even anything original because that's the film thinking that it's being smarter and cheekier than it actually is, right? Is trying to be like, see, he's kind of like Santa in a way, and he's supportive and all this kind of stuff. And I just...
And, you know, they're doing the healthy masculinity talks. And look, if we're going to look into that kind of film in itself as a prison film, then you've got Sing Sing. So it's not, you know, which we'll talk about at some point, you know, but...
Well, I think on a better level, you have a film like Christmas, right? Which is Heath Davis's film.
Which is a
film.
Christmas film, yeah.
Yeah, and that is a film that is about redemption. And I always thought, as soon as I saw that film, in fact, when I saw Broke, I had always thought, oh, Heath Davis would be the perfect person to adapt this song into a movie. And then we get Christmas, which feels like an adaptation of How to Make Gravy, but much better, and does it in a way that completely understands what the song is about. It is about connecting. It's about saying, again, it doesn't matter what crime you've done, you can be a good person. And this film is so twee, right? Instead of a dollop for tomato sauce, what they've done is added, buddy, 10 teaspoons of sugar, and that's it. And it's just, I don't think I've bounced off against a film like this in so long and have really found a disconnect to what it's trying to do. And maybe part of what I'm so frustrated by is that, you know, we've turned the 21st of December into Gravy Day. Like, it's become a national annual event when that's really not what the song should be. And I love Paul Kelly. I've seen him live multiple times. He was one of the earliest acts that I got to see as a kid. He's been part of my life for a long period of time. I've connected with his music throughout the years, and I find that this film, it just doesn't even listen to the lyrics, and it doesn't listen to who he is. And I know that he was creatively involved in it as well, but why wouldn't you be when you're getting paid money to do it, right? It doesn't matter then to him whether the film is good or not, because it's going to become something. And they're clearly trying to angle to be a musical of some sort, because there is Megan Washington's music in there and stuff like that. So much so that the Actor Awards then went and created an additional category this year for Best Song, which is amusing, because you can guarantee it won't be around next year. But there it is, Best Song, with two songs for How to Make Gravy in the film getting nominated. So it's hilarious that that's the case. But I just... And additionally, there is also Actor Award for Best Soundtrack too, which How to Make Gravy gets a nomination for that. I'm not sure how that works, but nonetheless... I'm perplexed by the Actor Awards completely.
I think that we can publicly say at this point, and not get into too much trouble because everybody's thinking it, they're a bit of an embarrassment for us.
Well, I'll put it this way. Where are the Actor Awards hosted? Yes, they're partially hosted on Channel 7, but they're also on Binge. Where can you watch How to Make Gravy?
Binge. And where are they physically taking place?
Oh, geez. The Gold Coast. The Gold Coast? Oh. It's the home of the arts, Nadine. Get the name right, please.
So you've just got the, you know, that you know why the film is so heavily represented in the actors. It's they own it. We don't have any idea really of the voting body. You know, who they are necessarily. It costs a lot of money, as filmmakers will have told you and have told me, to get their films on the voting platform to begin with. And
it's a truckload,
yeah, it is. And you know, we don't know who's actually putting their votes in the end, and that's kind of sad. So we don't have a breakdown, you know, like with the Academy, we know that there are X many voters because they're part of the Academy. With the Globes, we know that there are X many voters because...
Well, our names are public out there as well as voting members for the Globes, whereas there is nothing about the makeup of the awards for the membership for the Actor Awards. I've written about this at length, so I'll make sure to stick a link in the show notes for it, but I just... I have a level of cynicism when a film like How to Make Gravy gets the level of accolades that it does, and yet films like Christmas or He Ain't Heavy or In the Room Where He Waits or even Birdeater, two of those films don't get any nominations at all. Birdeater and Christmas only get a nomination for Best Indie Film. Like, come on. And same with You'll Never Find Me. Like, I'm sorry, but... Birdeater is a prime example of one of the greatness of what is being made in Australia right now, and the same with Christmas, and the same with He Ain't Heavy, which gets no recognition whatsoever. And I know that it's not about awards, I know it's not, but on the same hand, the whole entire point of the Actor Awards is to be able to say, this is us supporting the industry and making sure that we've got the best Australian filmmaking out there. I'm sorry, How to Make Gravy is not the best Australian filmmaking out there. It is a farce to be able to put that up there with 15 nominations and go, this is a shining example of what the Australian film industry is capable of. Because I can guarantee you, if somebody internationally watched this film, they're going to bounce off it and go, what is this? How is this a widely recognised film as being great. It's absurd. It's absolutely absurd. And all power to you if you're emotionally moved by it, but...
Watch Christmas instead. It's also on binge.
Yes. Yeah.
You can watch it there. And it's much, much better. And, you know, it just has... You know, the cast is stacked in a different way with seasoned industry, like hardworking professionals, whereas How to Make Gravy has just got name after name after name after name. And how on earth did they get Agatha Roussel from Titan to be in that film? Like, as Rita, what happened? How? Like, I'm sorry, I'm gobsmacked by the entire thing. But you can look forward to Brenton Thwaites in a much better film by Zach Hilditch called We Buried the Dead, coming up next year with Daisy Ridley. So things aren't all downhill for that. And I'm sure Hugo will do something worthwhile. And
well, Hugo is somebody who does, he does consistently good work, right? And that's a plus. But just because he does, like, he's always watchable. And I'm not saying he's bad here at all. I don't think that his performance is a terrible one, because he is such a good actor that he is able to fill in the gaps where the scripts or the direction isn't giving
him. I quite enjoyed Adam Briggs as well. You know, there are smaller roles that I liked. And, you know, it's always good to see Kim Gyngell on the screen again. But I just wish it was in something better, you know, something more worthy. And, you know, Hugo is consistently good, which is why I don't think he even has to open his eyes through most of this film. Like, he doesn't have to change tone or register. He's just doing, I'm Hugo Weaving and I bring gravitas to and gravy to almost everything. So
yeah. So yeah. What's your rating then for How to Make Gravy?
Well, you know, if I could unwatch it, I would. So I'm going to give it 1 star out of 5.
Yeah, I didn't actually rate this at all. And that sounds like such a cop-out to be like, I'm not rating this. But the reality is I don't think that I can objectively rate this film. But I would probably give it a 1 out of 5. It's just not for me. And I feel that it's a mess. What is for me, if we can, we'll wrap up with some quick recommendations of older films that people should seek out. And I'm going to go ahead as linking it to one of the films that we talked about earlier, which is Better Man.
I can't imagine a world without Take That. I can't imagine my life without Take That. The Back for Good film clip was so artistic. Oh, black and white, in the rain, dancing in slow motion. It's just unbelievable. How can this even be a thing?
One of my favourite documentaries that came out in 2018 by Jessica Leske. It's a film that I watch almost, like, at least twice a year. For some reason, I find it very, very comforting. It's very, very peaceful and easy watching, which is a documentary called I Used to Be Normal, A Boy Band Fangirl Story. It follows 4 different women who are basically fangirls of different groups: Backstreet Boys, One Direction, Take That, and The Beatles. So different generations of fangirls for boy bands. It's really calming. I don't know why, but I just love it. The woman who absolutely loves Take That, her stories about just being a adoring fan of Take That. She particularly loves Gary in particular, who isn't given a great rap in Better Man, but nonetheless, Gary, you can deal with it. I just love hearing her stories about it. And then her realization about her queer identity comes from Take That as well. And that's this acceptance and openness and support that the band gives the fans. I watch this film at least twice a year. Often I'll have it on in the background. I just find it really calming. But if you haven't seen it, please seek it out. I Used to Be Normal, or Boy Band Fangirl Story. It's on Doc Play, and you can rent it on a bunch of other places as well. Do you have an older film to recommend?
Yes, it's not extremely old. It's only a couple of years old, but it, you know, other than I'm linking it to Nosferatu. So obviously, other than, you know, watching the Murnau or watching the Herzog, which you should, and don't watch the English version of the Herzog. It's bizarre, absolutely bizarre. I am going to link it to the notion of hysteria and how women were treated in hospitals with Melanie Laurent's The Mad Woman's Ball, which is a film about Charcot and the hospital that investigated hysteria in women and depression and...
Non, je n'ai rien à faire ici. Maman, ça, ce n'est pas toi qui le décide. C'est ton père, enfin. C'était ton père.
You know, I used to study this kind of stuff because the surrealists in particular were very interested in kind of the poses of hysterics and melancholics. And so I didn't really look into how awful it was for the women involved. I was just like, oh yeah, that's all very fascinating. And Freud took a lot of his ideas from Charcot, and I was like, oh yes, these are problems I probably should have noticed before. But Laurent's film is just a really precise example of what was happening at the time in a fictionalized version, but enough for you to get an idea of just how horrific it was. And so, you know, unless those corsets, ladies, your womb isn't wandering and not crazy.
And if people want to see it, it's on Amazon Prime as well. So
yes, it's very easy to get a hold of.
Well, I've got it on my watch list, so I'll bump it up and catch that.
Well, when we can, you know, when we've had sleep.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, thank you again for the wonderful chat. Better Man is out in cinemas right now. Nosferatu is out in cinemas right now. We Live in Time, January 16th is when that hits out. If you want to listen to my interview as well with John Crowley, head over to thecurb.com.au where you can listen to a bunch of other interviews and stuff like that and read some articles and reviews and everything. And then you can also check out my Best Australian Films of the Year list too, which will be up live by the time this episode is up too, where How to Make Gravy is not on there, surprisingly.
Wow.
Enough.
Wow. Just, I'm shocked.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you could see my face. You can hear it in my voice. I'm deeply and profoundly shocked at this news.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Look, it is what it is. Anyway, thank you again for talking films with me. It's wonderful. We will be back again in the future to talk, no doubt, about Sing Sing, which is getting some screenings very, very soon in the new year. So we will talk about that and a bunch of other films that we don't know yet. So, you know, tune on in and we'll see you on the next episode.
As we just say,
gravy train, good taste and gravy too.
We just finished
recording in progress.
We just finished recording in progress.
Or that it makes a complete and when I add water, it makes gravy. Thick, beefy tasting gravy.